This is Kerry Swanson. Think of how radio used to sound and what it's like today. There have been huge changes over the decades, but at heart, radio is still a source of news, information, and entertainment. This was the subject of a special presentation by the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication and its Northwest Hall of Radio History. Before the panel discussed the future of radio, the program began with the nostalgic recreation of a live radio broadcast.
And now it's time for Northwest History Theater, brought to you by the Northwest Hall of Radio History. Tonight we present the heroic story of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman and their bold plan to save the Oregon country. Northwest Hall of Radio History at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication presents Northwest History Theater, a dramatic look back at the pioneers who put the great in the great Northwest. The time, 1842. The place, Wailiapu, the ryegrass prairie near Walla Walla, Washington, where Marcus and Narcissa Whitman built their mission in 1836 to bring the word of God to the Cayuse.
Husband, why do you fret so?
I'm worried, Narcissa.
Worried? About what? Are the Cayuse harming the crops again?
Yes, but it's not that.
No?
No. I'm worried that the president doesn't understand how important the Oregon country is to America, to America's future.
Oh, husband.
I'm afraid that they'll abandon us and let the British just keep this place for themselves.
Oh.
But let us go back to the beginning. Marcus and Narcissa Whitman were among a small group of young missionaries sent west from Boston. They chose to settle near the Cayuse Indians. Marcus Whitman constructed a crude cabin of cottonwood logs on the right bank of the Walla Walla River at Wailiapu, Cayuse for place of the ryegrass. Myron Eales, a missionary from Massachusetts who visited in 1838, described it thus.
It was built of adobe, mud-dried in the form of bricks, only larger. There are doors and windows of the roughest material, the boards being sawed by hand and put together by no carpenter, but by one who knows nothing about the work. The furniture is very primitive. The bedsteads and boards are nailed to the sides of the house, sink fashion. Then some blankets and husks make the bed.
In the 1830s, the Oregon country was the domain of Indians, Hudson Bay Company trappers, Catholic priests, and Protestant missionaries. The British and the Americans had agreed in 1819 to jointly occupy the land that now comprises Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. John Jacob Astor had tried and failed to build a settlement at what's now Astoria, and the British assumed they might keep the land north of the Columbia River for the empire. But Marcus Whitman felt otherwise. He wanted the rough and raw territory to become part of America.
I must tell the rest of America of the riches here, Narcissa. The unspoiled land, the agreeable climate. This is God's country, and it rightfully belongs to America.
Oh, husband, of course you're right. But what can one man do to change the course of history?
Why, I can tell the President John Tyler myself.
How?
If I leave tomorrow, I can make it to Washington before the winter sets in.
Oh, Marcus, no, I need you here with me.
Now, Narcissa, you knew that when you consented to become my wife, that there would be sacrifices. Coming west was one. Giving up the luxuries of modern society to live here among the ryegrass.
Yes, husband, but I gave up those things. To be with you.
This is bigger than you and me, sweet wife. This is about Oregon country. This is about God. This is about America.
Oh, Marcus, but you'll be gone for a year at least.
But I shall return to you, to Wailiapu, to an Oregon country where the stars and stripes shall fly overhead always. I could not countenance the Union Jack waving over this peaceful prairie. No, I could not.
I shall be strong then, for you, for Wai'iletpu, for God, and for America.
And I will do what I can to save Oregon. My life is of but little worth if I can't save this country for the American people.
And so it was that Marcus Whitman set out on a 3,000-mile journey across the continent. The poet Alice Wellington Rollins, borrowing inspiration from Longfellow's tribute to Paul Revere, memorialized what came to be known as Whitman's Ride.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of a hero's ride that saved a state. A midnight ride? Nay, child, for a year he rode with a message that could not wait. 1842, no railroad then had gone crashing through to the western coast. Not a telephone wire had guided there the electric fire. But a fire burned in one strong man's breast for a beacon light. You shall hear the rest.
Incredibly, Whitman crossed the continent in a matter of months, and he made it to the capital of the young nation early in 1843. Some say he actually met with President Tyler and made the case for the United States to take a stand against the British and claim the Oregon Territory for America. Satisfied that his work was done along the Potomac River, Whitman headed back to the banks of the Walla Walla. But this time, he didn't travel alone. Instead, he helped lead a wagon train that was part of the biggest migration to date along the Oregon Trail. As an old man in 1924, a settler named J.A. Stoughton remembered being part of that wagon train and how Dr. Whitman saved the day more than once along the route.
The wagon train of 1843 consisted of about 200 wagons. Another man had been taken as a guide, but after he got us into several pockets of trouble, Whitman brought the party through. Doc Whitman used to ride back and forth along the train, encouraging and giving advice, so we saw him practically every day of the long journey.
Husband, do my eyes deceive, or have you really returned?
Oh, Narcissa, there were times these last months when I thought I might never see you again.
Oh, Marcus, Marcus!
I'm not certain if I've done any good, but do know that I am certain that I had no choice but to try. I knew the mission was in your capable hands.
Oh, husband, of course my duties here to God are paramount, but I'm so fatigued, tending to our flock, human and otherwise. Oh, husband, it consumes my every waking moment.
Wai'iletpu was thriving, not so much as a mission, but as a much-needed place of rest on the Oregon Trail, and a home for the orphans and misfits who had no other place to go. A settler named Jesse Looney came to Wai'iletpu in that big migration of 1843 and described it this way.
I have stopped here in the Walla Walla Valley to spend the winter in order to save my stock. This is a fine valley of land, excellent water, good climate, and the finest kind of pine timber on the surrounding mountains. And above all, a good range for stock, both summer and winter. The Indians are friendly and have plenty of grain and potatoes, and a good many hogs and cattle.
But though the mission thrived, discontent grew among the Cayuse. Many of them felt that the Whitmans were disrespectful towards their traditional worship practices and, more ominously, that new diseases, including measles, were being purposefully used against them. A missionary named William Roberts described the deteriorating situation at Wai'iletpu in a letter home in 1847.
Wailepu is under the superintendence of Dr. Marcus Whitman, a physician and catechist. This station is near Fort Walla Walla, and not far from the traveled route from the United States to this country. In fact, many of the emigrants stop at this place for a time after their toilsome journey, and some who are too late or too feeble to get into the Willamette Valley remain there all winter. So it has happened that the emigrants have brought the measles with them into this country, the present season, and of course the Cayuse Indians, among the rest, have caught the contagion. Numbers of them have died.
'47 was the year, and November 29th was the day when the Whitman's dream came to a tragic end. One of the pioneers there at Wailepu was Mrs. Jason P. Carson.
I was washing the dishes when I heard the report of a gun. It was the gun that killed Jillian, the tailor. He was sewing when an Indian stood in the doorway and shot him. At the same time, the horrible work was going on outside. I and some others went upstairs where we could look from a window and see a part of the conflict. Meanwhile, Mrs. Whitman had barred the doors and windows to keep them out as long as possible. But it wasn't long before they broke in.
Mrs. Nancy Osborne Jacobs was there too, but she was just a little girl at the time.
The sudden and continuous firing of guns was the first alarm. Mrs. Whitman began to cry and the children to scream. Mother said, "Mrs. Whitman, what is the matter?" She replied, "The Indians are going to kill us all." Mother came back into our room and told us what was being done. Mrs. Whitman called out, "Fasten the doors," and Father took a flat iron from the fireplace and drove a nail above the latch on the outside of our room. Then he seated himself on a box by the foot of the bed on which lay my brother John, sick with the measles. Mother sat near the head of the bed and I was in between them. Mrs. Whitman came in soon after more water. Mr. Kimball had been wounded and had fainted. She came back a second time, asked for my father, and said, "My husband is dead and I am left a widow." She returned to her room wringing her hands. Mrs. Whitman fainted when she came down and saw her husband, Marcus, Dr. Whitman, dying. She was placed on a settee and carried by Mr. Rogers and an Indian. At the door, Mr. Rogers saw the circle of Indians with their guns ready to shoot, and dropping his end of the settee, he exclaimed,
"My God, we are betrayed!"
A volley from the waiting savages was his answer, and both he and Mrs. Whitman were mortally wounded. The Indians then told Joe Lewis that if he was on their side, he must kill Francis Sager to prove it. Francis was my schoolmate and about 14 years old. We heard him cry to Lewis,
"Oh, Joe, don't shoot me."
Then the crack of the gun, as Lewis proved his loyalty to the red men. As soon as it became dark, the Indians left for their lodges, of which a number were near. Everything became still. It was the stillness of death. All we could hear was the dying groans of Mr. Rogers, who lay within 6 feet of us. We heard him say,
"Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly."
And afterward, he said faintly,
"Sweet Jesus."
Then faint and fainter came the moans until they ceased altogether.
Though Marcus and Narcissa Whitman and 12 others died that day in 1847, the Oregon question was settled within a year, and Oregon Territory became part of the United States in 1848.
You know the rest. In the books you have read that the British were not a year ahead. The United States have kept Oregon because of one Marcus Whitman. He rode 8,000 miles and was not too late. In a single hand, not a nation's faith, perhaps, but a gift for the nation. She would hardly par with it today, if we may believe what the papers say upon this great Northwest. That was Oregon. And Whitman, my children, he and his wife now sleep in a martyr's grave. Murdered. Murdered, both he and she, by the Indian souls they went west to save.
This has been Northwest History Theater, performed before a live audience at the Washington State University Tri-Cities campus in Richland, Washington, as part of Evergreen Radio Live. Tonight's production was directed by Felix Bunnell and featured the voices of Dolores Rogers and Chris Topping. The sound effects designed and performed by Curtis Takahashi, and music composed and performed by Rob Jones. This program was produced by Felix Bunnell and Olivia Weitz for the Northwest Hall of Radio History at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication. Coming up next, a panel discussion about the future of radio in Washington State. This is Dave Ross speaking.
Thank you very much. You guys are fabulous, as always. That story, obviously, we took some liberties, as I said, with the dialogue, but most of the really rough language in there was from the original accounts of the settlers who witnessed that tragedy back then. So now you've been given a taste of what radio was like 70 years ago. So now I want to invite the panelists up to join me here on stage. Humanities Washington is a great organization. They fund projects like this all over Washington State to spark conversation and get people talking about interesting things. And I know everyone sitting in the room here cares about radio, and it's fabulous to be with people who care about radio, because radio is sometimes such a lonely thing to sit there and listen to it by yourself. So my personal interest in radio is about memory. I remember listening to Top 40 radio on KJR in Seattle in the 1970s. Is that a shout out for Top 40 KJR in the 70s? Yeah, all right. How about the Mariners on KBI in the late 70s? Anybody? Dave Niehaus? Yeah. Okay, I was an insomniac even as a 10-year-old. Larry King overnights on Cairo in the late 70s. Open Phone America. Fred Lowry is the announcer. And then New Wave Radio on KYYX and KJET in the early 80s. Any people? Yeah, okay. I figured that would be the one that would get the cricket noise. There's also even more bizarre stuff that I remember about radio, like listening during the Cold War with my dad on his shortwave radio, listening to Radio Moscow and Joe Adamoff, you know, spinning the latest events in world history in favor of the Soviets, and listening to Radio Havana back at the height of the Cold War. And then talking with my mom, who grew up in London during World War II, about all the wacky programs that the BBC had. I mean, you think American radio is weird. Listen to some of those British programs from the 30s and 40s. They're beyond description. So, but, you know, all the stuff that I'm talking about, there's nothing as bizarre as DXing. Raise your hand if you know what DXing is. Okay, so that's, all right, so a few of you. The idea of listening, tuning in faraway radio stations that you're not supposed to be able to hear late at night in the winter. I remember doing that as a child, hearing stations from Wyoming and Idaho and California. And anyway, that's what radio is. It's very personal. That's all in the past, though. The rest of the program tonight is about the future. You hear that radio is at a crossroads. You hear that other forms of audio entertainment and other places for advertisers to spend their dollars are killing radio as we know it. Is it true? I don't know. You know, radio's been down before. Back when TV was first on the scene in the late 40s and early 50s, everyone said, radio's dead. But radio reinvented itself. It moved from the living room to the dashboard, or the living room to the bedroom, or the teenage transistor radio at the beach. So radio not only survived television, it thrived and reinvented and became a whole new, more intimate medium. Audio entertainment's everywhere now. Everyone has an audio player on their phone. You have audio, more audio than you've had access to. Almost everything in the history of mankind you can get just with your phone now. But still, for some reason, these people still come to work every day at their radio stations and put on radio programming for us, and that we're excited about that. So we're not shy. We're not shy about revealing our bias. We want local radio to survive and thrive here in Washington and Idaho and Oregon and all over. So have a great panel joining us here on stage to talk about the future of radio. You've already met Carrie Swanson. Next to Carrie is Dave Ross from Cairo in Seattle, Tom Mara from KEXP in Seattle, Ricardo Garcia from Radio Cadena, Jeff Hansen from KUOW, and I was going to call her a low-power FM advocate, but I think that makes it sound like she is low-powered, but she's not. She's an advocate for low-power FM, Sabrina Roach. So let's start with a big question, a big wide-open question, and I'll let whoever wants to answer this first raise your hand. Why is radio still relevant? Who wants to take that one? Dave?
I'll take it.
Okay.
And I think the question that is actually more apropos is, why do we have a transmitter? And I think the reason we have a transmitter is because, first of all, it's the one medium where when 2 million people tune in or when two people tune in, it never has to buffer. But number two, it's a heartbeat. It's live. If it's done well, there's always a thinking person there to decide whether the thing I'm putting on the air right now is the best possible thing to be putting on, is what people want to hear. Significantly, when something big happens, when there's a 9/11, your podcast, your canned podcast, is suddenly completely irrelevant. But in, what, the 6,000 live-staffed radio stations around the country, there's somebody there who is about to swing into action, rip up the schedule, throw out the commercials, throw out the log, and start live wall-to-wall broadcasting. That's what we do best. Our challenge now is to try to keep the lights on when things are normal. And that's the thing we face every day now.
So Dave, or anybody, is the revenue there from advertising or from underwriting or contributors to support what you're talking about during the non-9/11, non-Super Bowl times?
Well, Felix, could I...
Go ahead, Jeff. Yeah.
Could I add to what Dave said? I think he's absolutely right. What we're finding in public radio is we have so many canned shows that are now getting audiences as a podcast audience. And so people are leaving radio to listen to the podcast, because it's not something that radio alone can uniquely do well. It's the live that is going to be radio's future. In the moment, news and information and so forth, things that can be recorded can also be podcast, and they're actually more convenient for listeners to listen to as a podcast. One thing you can't do to radio is you cannot play, pause, and skip. You can with a podcast, and that makes long-form programs actually much better as podcasts. So the future of radio programs is probably podcasting, but the future of radio is live broadcasting.
And see, and that's, isn't that ironic? Because the first 20, 30 years of radio was all live. Other than some recorded music, there was very little in the way of taped programming at all. Mm. So here we are, we've come full circle in just about 70 years. The difference between podcasts, though, and live radio, it's a totally different experience, right? Because you can control it, and because it's the live radio, as Dave said, the live broadcast is tuned into what's going on. What about the local aspect, local versus live, or how important is that? Because there's a few critical live programs on that are national.
Critical. In fact, that's also part of the future, especially with public radio, where we're all playing the same stuff at the same time that increasingly is available in other ways. So it's going to be, how do we make it local? How do we add value as a local community to all of that national content?
Carrie?
That's a real good point, because, you know, every community has a story to tell. Everybody within a community wants to feel connected to their neighbors. And radio allows you to do that, whether it's the high school football game or the hydroplane races or, you know, that concert that everybody got to go to and they heard about it on the radio that night. You know, that community connection is still a vital thing that you're not going to necessarily find in the podcasts.
But how much of that community function, and I agree with you about that, but how much of that community function has been shifted into social media and people live tweeting while they're at the baseball game or whatever, or the high school football game?
There's always live tweets and things like that, but, you know, always have to consider that editorial curation of that expert that's on the radio, that has the Associated Press wire, that has the mobile news unit coming in. You know, it still has that gravitas and that connection of authority than it does with Facebook, you know.
Do 20-year-olds care about that kind of stuff, though?
I've seen a lot of 20-year-olds really excited about community radio once again with Low Power FM. I've never seen this kind of interest in community media.
Why don't you describe what Low Power FM is for people who might not know what that is?
Sure. Who knows what pirate radio is? Yeah? Okay, a lot of folks know what pirate radio is. So Low Power FM is essentially legalized pirate radio. So right now it's something that's available at 100 watts, and the Federal Communications Commission just made these licenses available. Almost 3,000 nonprofits, faith-based organizations, tribal governments, and schools applied in 2013, and about 2,000 of these groups will actually get them. About 1,700 are building currently around the country. So one of the useful things about Low Power FM is that universities that have full power stations, student groups at those universities could also apply for Low Power FM. So it's creating more space for young people to get their sea legs in radio, to try something out when no one's listening, quote unquote. There's a lot of innovation that can happen there, and it also gives them, as well as other community members, just a space, a learning community, and access to tools and training that they might not have otherwise. You know, I think it would cost about $2,000 for you to get a laptop and mics at home, for you to create that podcast in your basement, if you will. But this makes it just more accessible to more people.
Who pays for LPFM?
The applicants.
How much does it cost
Sure. About $60,000 to build one of these. That includes the equipment, permitting, whatever kind of stick you place it on. It doesn't really go on a tower exactly. You can make something happen with less money, but that's what I'm telling folks.
That's a great segue. Speaking of less money, is the revenue there for commercial radio or public radio to actually support this stuff? I love... Oh, go ahead, Ricardo. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, talking about money, and let me say that I represent Radio KDNA. And if you sound out KDNA, the letters in Spanish, it means cadena. And cadena means a link chain. And the idea 36 years ago was to link the farm worker community in Idaho, Oregon, Washington through radio. And we did it. It wasn't easy, but it happened in the Yakima Valley. And Radio KDNA, the voice of the farm worker, became the very first full-time Spanish language radio, community radio in the United States, and broadcasting out of Granger, Washington, a very small community in the heart of the Yakima Valley. For 36 years, KDNA has struggled with money because it hasn't been easy finding underwriters. The listeners are farm workers who don't have a lot of money. They don't make a lot of money. That was one of the biggest issues and continues to be an issue of wages. KDNA has survived through the generosity of friends who are Anglos, who understand the importance of radio, educational radio for the Spanish speakers. Money has come also from CPB. We're eligible for the grant that CPB gives out yearly. Underwriters, very hard to find for a Spanish language radio back in the 80s, simply because we were broadcasting to a community that were farm workers. And farm workers being very much influenced by the movement of Cesar Chavez, the agricultural industry was very afraid of Cesar Chavez coming into the Yakima Valley. And therefore, the word went out that this radio station that opened in December of 1979, that went on the air in 1979, we have to keep an eye on it because they're broadcasting messages that are not conducive for good relationships between employers and workers. That's been the challenge of Radio KDNA. How do you get the word out that the radio station, KDNA, is simply educating, informing a very important labor force in the state of Washington, Eastern Washington, and that it was important for that community of farm workers to settle down. Mostly in the 40s, 50s, 60s, the farm workers were from Texas, U.S. citizens, but they unfortunately, they had been discriminated, let me say that, and they had not acquired an education, academic education, and so on. They were very good workers, but they didn't speak English, although they were U.S. citizens. And the purpose of the radio station, the mission at that time was, we have to convince this labor force to settle down, establish roots, stay in the state of Washington, educate your kids, send them to school. And that's what Radio KDNA became. It became educational, informational. We mobilized the community. We organized the community. We had a very captive audience in 1979, 1980s.
Is your radio signal as important as it was 36 years ago? Are you guys doing stuff online? Or tell me what's
very
it like now?
Much so.
Still the same. Okay.
We're now, the station is now streaming, so it can be heard through the internet, wherever. But the importance of the radio station remains because we're still waiting for immigration reform. The agricultural industry is waiting for immigration reform because in our state, we have a population that continues to grow every day. As we speak here tonight, people are arriving from Mexico wanting to do farm work. The industry needs them. They need them to cut asparagus right now. There's a shortage of asparagus workers. And they're taking chances. They're hiring them, although they're undocumented. So, but that's the power of radio.
Yeah, and so the niche that you guys serve, it sounds like, Sabrina, a little bit of what you're talking about, where the radio, it's, if people are passionate enough, they'll come up with $60,000 from somewhere, or if it's a passionate enough, very specific niche community, the resources will come. But then you look at more broadly serving organizations like KUW and your repeaters in Western Washington and Northwest Public Radio all over the state, and Cairo with its big signal in the West, and KXP Online. You're drawing from a much bigger pool of potential revenue, either underwriters or donors or advertisers. Are the advertisers you read every day, or not every day, that's an exaggeration, but it's a discussion, so I can exaggerate, that people are going to be spending much more money on internet advertising and very targeted Google advertising and stuff like that. Is radio hurting because of that, because of the revenue that's going to internet spending?
I've never been more excited or more hopeful about the impact we're trying to generate with our services. And KXP, back in 99 when we started streaming, we were actually kind of late to the game in terms of streaming our music service. KXP has a music discovery format. We're trying to bring music into your life that you haven't discovered yet. And we do that by relying on the curatorial voices of 45 DJs. There's nobody like me or even our program director, our music director, prescribing the music that you hear on our station. It's given, that authority is given to our DJs. When we started streaming, we had an unusual experience. We started getting requests from Indianapolis and from Iceland and from Vietnam. And it posed a fundamental question that I think we answered correctly, 15 years ago. And that was, are we going to become, geographically generic, or are we going to embrace our local community even more? And we decided to go with the latter. If anything, we became more Seattle-centric, we became more Northwest-centric. Back then, we had two full-time staff. We had a $250,000 a year organization, and we started investing in serving people online. We have a mighty 4,700 watts beaming out of Capitol Hill. Our radius is fairly short. So for us to reach more people and get these artists that deserve to be heard into their lives, we had to invest online. And through the years, by investing in podcasting, in on-demand audio and video, and live streaming, and also live video casting, as well as our partnership with YouTube, back then we were serving 50,000 people a week. We now serve 1 million people a week, and we've grown to a $7 million organization. And through that, we've connected so many more artists that deserve to be heard to so many more people in the ways that are relevant to them.
So here's a question about the regional aspect. I mean, Seattle has KXP. Is there a need for other stations, or is the opportunity for similar stations in other parts of the country, or is your model so special that it's kind of a one-off thing?
Well, I'm not sure if it's so special. I think one reason why KXP is in Seattle is because of Seattle's currency of creativity. I mean, we have never had more music being created and published than there is right now. We've never seen a greater diversity in that music being published right now. This is a renaissance time, and if we didn't have that, then we would not be nearly as relevant to these people's lives as we are right now. We play Seattle Northwest artists every hour, and we see ourselves as an ambassador of Seattle's music creativity to the rest of the world. So if you've got that creativity in your local community, then you've got opportunity to connect that to many.
Here's one of the things that I find irritating. I worked at Cairo for a couple of years, like 25 years ago, and at that point, Cairo had a radio signal, and they put out several hours of live program every day, talk shows, morning news, midday news, afternoon news, overnights with Larry King, of course, or whoever it was back then. Larry moved on, I think, to TV. But that's all it did. That was pretty romantic, to think of this little radio station, little studio in Seattle, an antenna over on Vashon Island, pumping out this one signal, and there's only a couple dozen stations in the whole region, and everyone's tuned in from home or whatever, and you have this power of this voice. Now, if you're a radio station, you got to have a video production unit, you got to have someone running your website and doing your social media. All these other lines of business have been heaped on to this industry that was originally just about the human voice connecting over time and distance. And that makes me mad. I mean, it just sort of makes it like, come on, let's just do the radio show.
Make
let's
you mad?
Do it. I think
everybody who does a podcast or runs a low power radio station is still going to find out that it is not easy to fill 24 hours with live programming. And what they will do is reinvent the Cairo newsroom, basically. And that's what we have had to do with fewer people. We now have four people who are, I actually don't know how many people we have devoted to the web services now. They exist in strange parts of the building. But you have to have people who understand broadcasting, who understand writing, who understand how to give an opinion succinctly, who understand how to cut through the noise of driving to work, because that still seems to be the one area where radio rules, and that is traffic reports, getting people to and from work in the morning and the afternoon. And so we focus on that, and we also have another battle in commercial radio. I wish we had a built-in audience like you do among the farm workers who basically have to listen to you because there's no other source of that information. But we are biting and scratching for every listener that we can get, and so we have to be interesting every second of every day. And so the moment, every minute on a radio station is the front page of the newspaper. So we have to program it so that whether you've been listening all day or just tuned in right then, you know exactly what we're talking about, and what we're saying is so captivating you cannot bring yourself to reach that dial and twist it even the slightest fraction of an inch. People don't do that for free forever. It takes a commitment. So I get up at 3:55 in the morning and put the morning news together. And at 9 o'clock, I take a walk for a mile to get rid of the stress. Then we come back and we have a production meeting. And then I go home and I sometimes take a nap or sometimes take my little iPhone and start doing what? Reading news again. And then by 4 o'clock in the evening, I start going back to the file to see what people have written and to start writing and preparing the stories for tomorrow and preparing a commentary, and then get to bed maybe by 10 o'clock and wake up at 3:55. Again, and do that 5 days a week. So it's a commitment, and that's why I want to keep radio alive as well, because it's really difficult to do that and to think that no one's listening to it.
Why
except
is it?
My mom back home.
Yeah. Why is it? It seems to be another commonality. People I talk to who work in more so even radio than TV. This passion for the industry, the passion for the work that transcends what it pays or doesn't pay, or transcends the having to go to bed at 7 o'clock and get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, which isn't the ideal shift, but that's when the most people are listening.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is it about the passion that people who are in the industry, the passion they have for it, what's that all about?
There's something about that human connection. I know that I get up every morning because somebody is relying on the information that we've got, and we make those real that power, that human voice is connects. I mean, just in the stage thing, I mean, I could close my eyes and I was right there. There's just something about that human interaction and connection that just can't be replicated. I know that even in public broadcasting, we have folks, they've supported the station for so many years that then they've decided this is such a good thing that they want to keep going that they put us in their will, because that's how much of an impact we have made on their life, and they want that, you know, for the next generations and next generations. I can't put my finger on why, but it definitely exists.
I can tell you what the appeal is for me. Close your eyes. This is Dave Ross broadcasting to you from WCBS in New York City. Now open your eyes. Which is more impressive?
Yeah. It is neat to be talking to a microphone and know that like tens of thousands of people have to listen to you because
I hate to go out in public.
Yeah.
I'd rather have them imagine me as what I sound like rather than what I look like.
So let's talk about a couple things. I have a couple nitpicks about public radio that I want to ask about. One is and with all due respect to their families, the number of dead people who are on NPR these days, with the Car Talk brothers, one who's now deceased, that's still on every week on lots of public radio stations, and now Richard Schur, who's passed away with Says You. When will these people who've passed away move on so new people can start shows that will fill in these slots?
The listeners decide, Felix, and as long as they turn out by the tens of thousands to listen, our job is to provide public service, and they're demanding that.
So is Car Talk still delivering the same numbers in the broadcast? And
yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not really complaining. I listen every week.
We worry and talk a lot about the next generation of talent and leadership at KXP, and it's gotten to be such an important topic. When we had to decide where to locate our studios, we decided to locate them at Seattle Center campus. We're moving in later this year. One of the major reasons being its adjacency to the Vera Project, being a youth-run, youth-operated music venue arts organization. And we saw that as a strategic matter. So we could glean the energy, the philosophy, the spirit of young folks to help us do an even better job in this very difficult work of music discovery. It's so hard for any sort of medium to try to bring the unfamiliar to people's lives. And by being next to Vera Project, I think they're going to help us discover what is relevant, what is important to young folks.
Yeah. So if you're 18 or 19 years old and you love radio and you go ask Carrie, like, hey, I want a career in radio. What do you tell somebody that age who wants to do radio?
Absolutely. It may not look exactly as it does today, and 20 years ago it didn't look like it did then, and so on and so forth. Our first station went on the air in 1922. I just happened to have an old program.
What a coincidence. How did that happen? Yeah.
Here's some of the things that were aired on that station. If you tuned in on December 22nd, you would hear things like a piano concerto from Florence Carpenter, something called The Latest News, a look at fashions for 1923. I don't know, maybe the skirt line went up above the ankles, I'm not
yeah.
sure. There's a discussion about the latest technology in agriculture. Okay, so 90 years ago, news, culture, music, entertainment, we're still doing that today. That's just part of the human connection. I think that's still going to be there 100 years from now. It may also appear on my iPod. It may appear on whatever else the new technology is, but you know, that curation of that programming still has to happen someplace.
Yeah, I would agree. I think radio will survive, although it may be very different. There was a prediction out in the last year or two that suggested that in 10 years, which would now be eight or 9 years, 50% of the transmitters will go dark, because of the fragmentation of the audience across multiple audio platforms and other platforms. And the challenge for those of us still in radio is to make sure ours is one of those that survives among the 50%. I think what Dave Ross was saying about making every second the headline, making every second count, and what Tom is doing about stretching the signal across multiple platforms, and Sabrina bringing youth into radio and low power FM in multiple ways. So I think it will survive, but it's going to be very different than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, question about NPR stuff, like a weekly show like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is available as a podcast, has been for the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years maybe. When it was first on 15 years ago, I listened to it. I never missed a show. I always heard it live. Mm-hmm. I heard the underwriting announcements at 20 and 40 and all, like, you know, the local support for it. I don't hear those anymore when I hear the podcast, which I assume means fewer ears hearing the underwriting announcements means you can charge less for it. So somewhere or other, audiences for a great national show don't need Northwest Public Radio or don't need KUW to get that show. And that seems like that, like, there's some sort of a graph where that sort of the local station, need for the local station completely goes away in that model. Is that...
That's going to be part of the challenge. That's why this prediction came out that 50% of the current signals will go dark. Those stations and that can't figure out where the unique position of radio is in the future are going to have trouble. The future of programs is probably podcasts. We see it all the time in radio that when we stop doing programming that's in sync with the way radio can work the best, we see the numbers go down.
You know, I think radio is still going to be a gateway, though. When I was in jazz radio and classical radio, you know, we couldn't play every tune that Ornette Coleman ever did because that's pretty intense, you know. But it was enough that if you were interested, you might discover and then expand your own horizons to something else. And as you found that podcast, then that's become your favorite. But you'll think about, where did I find that first, you know, discovery? Where was that well? Let me go back to that and find other things that I like, too. And I think radio is going to be part of that.
Let me just make one other point, and that is the factor of a surprise. When you are doing something live and programming every day and linking it to current events, you get surprised every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I find that if I listen to the same podcast over and over, pretty soon I know what their shtick is, and I know what they're going to talk about. And it's not as much fun, I think, to be your own editor as to let somebody else into your life. The other thing is that there needs to be a level playing field, and I think this is in Sabrina's interest as well. I know that, I don't know whether the iPhone, I think the iPhone has one, but most cell phones have an FM radio chip in it, which hasn't been activated, either through hardware or through software. And if low-power radio is going to make it, I think there needs to be some pressure, and there is a campaign on the web to pressure the hardware manufacturers into activating that chip. The other thing is that I think for radio to be an effective mass medium, it needs to be free. And data charges for streaming radio all the time can really get expensive. And at some point, these companies are probably going to put a meter on it because there's so much demand for streaming media now, and they just up the resolution of television broadcasts, exponentially, that these things are going to get clogged. And I still don't think there's a substitute. There's no better model, both economically and in terms of technology, than a transmitter pumping out a mass signal for a mass audience. You don't have to worry about buffering. You don't have to worry about it going dark every time there's a power outage.
Or that delay.
No charge transmission, and it's always on. Yeah.
Sabrina, you were going to say something, then you, Tom, okay.
Well, there's something that's very troublesome to me. Just in the last week, I think it was, Norway announced that they're switching off FM radio in 2017.
The analog, yeah.
Analog, and they're switching to digital. I think that's interesting. That's of note. I've had some chats with congressional staffers who have said some very concerning things about Spectrum along those lines. But I really appreciate, Dave, that you brought up the cost of data. And there are more cities and towns looking into municipal broadband. That's great, but it's worrisome. So right now, radio is the least expensive media to make, which is great. And I don't know the numbers, but worldwide, it's still the most listened to. And in the States, it's got better numbers than the podcast and the streaming. So for right now, that's a good thing.
For right now, okay.
For right now.
Tom, you're going to say something?
Oh, As I mentioned, we do a lot of live performance, and there's the magic of bringing the artists as close as possible to you and sharing that experience. And you know, last year we did more than 500. We video capture them, and we've got an agreement with YouTube to further distribute them. So fast forward to, was it 2 years ago, we're sponsoring a music festival not too far from here, the Sasquatch Music Festival, and we've got our tent, and I'm handing out buttons and bumper stickers. And this fellow comes across the booth, he's about 10 feet away, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and I think he was already working on his blood alcohol content, but he was still with us. And he pointed at me as he's walking by, and he said, you know, love your YouTube channel. And I said, well, thanks. And I beckoned him, and because, you know, I want to give out these bumper stickers and pins. And we talked, he's from Colorado, nice little conversation. And I said, well, if you're ever in Seattle, come by the radio station. We'd love to give you a tour. And he looked at me, and he tilted his head, and he said, you have a radio station? It's a true story. 5 years ago, we had to begin thinking of ourselves as an arts organization that happens to have a radio station. Yeah. And that's why we've invested in these other platforms. And it's not too unlike, one maybe analogy here is not too unlike the railroads, who really did great work in keeping trains on rails and thought of themselves as railroads, not so much as in the business of moving things from point A to point B. And so we've had to redefine how to get things from point A to point B in the most relevant ways, in the most magical ways, in the most compelling ways in terms of music discovery, and that's why we've invested in these various ways.
You're turning into Amtrak, is what you're saying?
Right.
No. Ricardo, you were going to say something, and I didn't get back to you.
As I listen, I have more questions in my mind than commentaries. But working with the Spanish language community and finding out the power of radio was enlightening. And the Spanish language community in not only in the state of Washington but throughout the country is growing. But I don't think there's a connection between English speaking radio and Spanish language radio. And the challenges of the future are huge. There isn't enough dialogue in radio talking about the future of the United States as it relates, as things are happening right now. Racial tensions are back, very, very, very serious. In our community, people are afraid of immigrants. They're creating a barrier to communications, to relationships. And Spanish language radio in the Yakima Valley has some of those answers. But it's only answers among people that speak Spanish. We haven't connected with radio stations that also care about the country and the future of the country or the future of the state of Washington or the future of the agricultural industry. Politically speaking, in our area, for example, our new congressional representative is against immigration reform. To them, it's more important border control, protecting the border. But that doesn't help any. I mean, at a time when the country really needs to stop, and radio can do it. I mean, the challenges of radio has to be focused now on the future of the United States. What are we going to do about creating better understanding what's in our country? There's so much diversity. There are so many languages being spoken, and not being afraid to speak them anymore. And there's so much fear of English becoming a second language, and I wish I could tell people through our radio who are listening, who are Anglos, not to be afraid, because it's just a history of immigrants. Many immigrants, but generations that are first speaking only Spanish, second generation English and Spanish, and then the third generation, it's all English. Our country speaks English, but nobody's delivering that positive message to people who are so fearful of the Spanish language. And radio can be that vehicle to do so.
We are looking for someone who we could call up as the news warrants and give us a Hispanic perspective on Marco Rubio, on immigration reform, on building walls. And if you have someone like that, let me know, because we'll put them on the air. That's exactly what we're looking for. We want to get away from our canned programming and handle every topic live with someone who knows what they're talking about, so that we're not wasting people's time with just idle opinion. So if you have someone like that, you know where to contact me.
Wait, right? You're not wasting time with idle opinions anymore? What are you guys going to do instead?
I mean, that's, I know.
Yeah, no.
It's tough, but at least between 6 and 9, when I'm on
okay,
now,
okay.
We're cracking on all sides.
I love those idle opinions, personally. That's why I tune in every day, several hours a day. We talked about podcasts a little bit earlier. Anyone in this room listened to the Serial podcast last year? Yeah, that was quite the phenomenon. And that was introduced as an episode of This American Life. So it was introduced by Terrestrial Radio and a pretty popular podcast. But it sort of seemed like that was the first thing that brought podcasting into the way, way mainstream. It's something that everyone was talking about. I think they did a parody on Saturday Night Live, which, I mean, that's an indication that something has arrived, probably.
And by the way, that was not available for broadcast on radio. That was podcast only.
Well, I think it's important to pay attention to where that talent comes from, where these ideas come from. And a lot of the talent for some of the most popular, successful podcasts come, those folks started at public radio stations. And their talent was nurtured there. They used the studios, they used the mics. That comes from somewhere. And I think that's really a great concept that you bring up, Tom, of radio station as arts organization. And I know with the Low Power FMs, I'm encouraging them to think of themselves as arts nonprofits more than as just a radio station.
Well, we're just about reaching the end of the hour here. Is there any questions from the audience? Oh, sir, we have a couple.
There's one advantage that radio has that nobody's addressed yet, and that is that someone listening to the radio engages their own imagination. Mm-hmm. And
I'll clap for that too.
I just wonder if there's, well, the only one I can think of is Garrison Keillor in news from Lake Wobegon. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of anybody else, and he grabs the whole audience.
Yeah.
And why? Because people get to use their imagination. I think it's worth some thought.
Absolutely. Amen.
I have a saying, others have said it too. The pictures on radio are a lot better than the ones on TV.
All right. Well, is there any more audience questions?
And when I was listening to Ricardo talk about his station and the role it plays in the Spanish-speaking community over in Yakima. And I was wondering if you thought that the role of radio or the future of radio for the Spanish-speaking community in places like Yakima and others around here is different than the future of radio for the English-speaking community.
Well, I believe it is very, very, very different, because the audiences that are listening to Spanish language radio, community radio, and that's the reference that I have, are folks that are monolingual Spanish speakers, and they're not acquainted to receiving information that's relevant to their lives. They're accustomed to commercial Spanish language radio, which is, in my way of thinking, very inferior. Spanish language radio will always be behind and not in the forefront.
All right. Well, you've been a wonderful audience. A couple things I want to say. It seems like for radio to succeed, or so we can have this discussion again in 5 or 10 years, you have to love it. You have to absolutely be passionate about it. That seems like to be no question. You have to have the will to be live and local to serve that audience. You have to have an audience, and you have to have some way to monetize that audience. That's my favorite new word in the dictionary, monetize. Everything has to be monetized. So if you have that love, the audience, and the will, and the money, it seems like radio does have a future. That seemed like a good summing up of what we said here tonight. That's what it seems
Hallelujah.
Like to me. Yeah. Well, this was a great way to have an inaugural program for the Northwest Hall of Radio History at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication. I have a lot of faith in the future of radio, thanks to people like you and people like you guys. And so on behalf of co-producer Olivia Wheats, I want to thank everybody. I'm Felix Bunnell for the Northwest Hall of Radio History. Thank you. Good night.
Recorded at the WSU Tri-Cities campus on April 25th, this program is supported in part by a grant from Humanities Washington. a statewide nonprofit organization supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the State of Washington, and contributions from individuals and foundations. Additional support was provided by the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication and its Northwest Hall of Radio History. I'm Carrie Swanson.